This is a Defocus Media production. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Today we have a really interesting topic that many of us haven't really heard much about in depth, so this is a really great opportunity to expand our horizons and think about something that's thought-provoking and in the near to long-term future, I think will definitely be affecting eye care. It's a topic surrounding eye care in space. It's not an environment that a lot of us work in, but it's an environment that, as you'll see here through our discussion, does have a lot of eye-related consequences. Joining me to discuss this topic is my good friend Nitya Murthy. Nitya is a fourth-year optometry student at the Kentucky College of Optometry. During optometry school, she served in various leadership positions, both at the local and national level, which included serving as president and national historian of the National Optometric Student Association, as well as founder and president of the Kaiko Cornea and Contact Lens Society. She also served as charter lion and treasurer of the Pikeville Lions Club for 3 years and continues to be an active member of her local Lions Club. Nitya has published research in contact lens and ocular surface disease, as well as the effects of a microgravity environment on ocular physiology. Thank you for joining us today, Nitya.
Hey, Fayaz. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I'm curious, you know, this is a topic that you and I have chatted about in person from time to time, and I've been really impressed with your knowledge about it and your interest in it. Can you give us a little bit of a background of how you became interested in space and how eye care ties into that?
Yeah, so space is just one of those things that I think it's like universally really fascinating for everyone. Something that I was interested in from a young age. I went to space camp every summer when I was little. I'm from Florida, so I went to the Kennedy Space Center space camp and stuff. And I was always interested, of course, in our undergraduate studies. We get a lot of physics and things like that in preparation for optometry school. And, you know, that it was just a hobby and an interest. But when I started reading about how astronauts' vision was changing in space, I got obviously very excited and I did a lot more digging. And, you know, just by the luck of like contacts and networking and, you know, optometry meetings and things like that, I was able to get connected with some researchers down at NASA, and we got to working on some things. So that was really exciting for me.
That's awesome. You can't just speed past that. You actually worked with NASA?
Yeah, in the sense that I went down to Johnson Space Center a couple years ago. It was a trip that was coordinated by some mentors that I met along the way, just, you know, during all of this. And one of the optometrists down there had me come visit and talk to me about the research that they were doing. He's an OD PhD, Dr. Tyson Brunstetter. He's an OSU grad, and he's an optometrist that works at JSC. And he had me come down, meet the other optometrists that work there, meet this team, see the different labs and things like that, and talk to me about the very puzzling question that everyone is facing, which is, why does vision change in space? It was kind of unexpected that it happened and that it happened recurrently. And from those conversations, I developed my own research project that I conducted back at my school with Dr. Brunstetter's guidance and the research that was being done at NASA. And I presented my work at ARVO earlier this year.
How did that feel actually being at a conference as an optometrist and presenting about eye care in space? I'm sure there weren't many posters like yours.
No, there weren't. It was incredibly nerve-wracking because ARVO is very, very research heavy. And at my poster, before the poster session started, there were researchers from NASA who are already there prepared to ask questions and talk with me about it. And, you know, they were very friendly and wonderful people, but it was just very intimidating for me at first because, you know, you're trying your best. I'm an optometry student still, and I had my part of my research done, but obviously it's just an immense world of research that's going on. So that was definitely, one of the scarier moments of optometry school, but an awesome learning experience.
Yeah, I bet. Can you tell us a little bit more kind of a background of some of the eye-related conditions that the researchers are working on and some of the challenges as far as vision that the space environment actually poses to astronauts?
Yeah, so one of the things is obviously humans weren't made to live in space, right? So a lot of physiological changes take place. The ones that people are very familiar with are, you know, muscles losing strength, bone density changing, bodily fluid shifting, and all of that. But in the eyes, what they started finding was both unilateral and bilateral optic disc edema, globe flattening that was causing hyperopic shifts, choroidal and retinal folds, and nerve fiber layer infarcts, so cotton wool spots and things like that, to a point where astronauts were developing blurry vision both during and after flight, and they were packing like their space glasses. This was a phenomenon that they were just so familiar with and expecting that it became a part of their journey for them. But of course, it shouldn't be happening, right? These are astronauts. These are all scientists who are completely correctable to 2020 or 2015. But they were ending up at like 2100 after spaceflight, and people didn't know why. And people still don't fully understand why, but now a lot more work has been done.
That's definitely a dramatic impact, especially when you're working in an environment where attention to detail is so critical, and having some of those types of vision changes must be really concerning to both the astronauts and also everyone who has a role to play in the mission.
Yeah, the phenomenon is called spaceflight-associated neurocular syndrome. So SANS is what we're calling it.
Are these things persistent after the astronaut returns to Earth, or is this kind of a temporary situation as far as what they've seen currently?
It is consistent after they come back down to Earth. There are terrestrial changes that are still marked and notable. The visual acuity was resolved after 6 months or so in most cases. Of course, we're talking about a very small sample size because we are talking about astronauts who completed long-duration space flights at the ISS. But even so, the structural changes persisted, so the cotton wool spots and things like that.
Is there a time frame where it's noticed that these things actually develop over? Can it be developed over a week, a day, several months? And what kind of research has been gathered on that? And does it correlate also to when they return to Earth? If they've been in space longer, do they take longer to recover? Tell us a little bit more about that.
So those are things that are being looked at right now. They're trying to map out a more exact timeline as to when and how much exposure to microgravity it maybe takes for these changes to start occurring. So that's being looked at. A new OCT was sent to the ISS pretty recently with the goal of mapping these changes more exactly. So I think in the coming years, we'll see that timeline get fleshed out a little bit more.
That's really exciting. So they actually have an OCT at the space station for them to use pretty much at all times now?
Yeah, they actually have a lot of things up there. So they have the near and far VA charts. They have AMSAR grids. They have the tonopen. So tonometry has actually been a main thing that's been looked at. And that's what I did my research on as well. There's an ocular ultrasound up there. They do direct fundoscopy, and there's an A scan, a transcranial Doppler, really, really cool equipment.
Are they using this equipment on a regular basis, or is it kind of in chunks of time as they kind of take serial measurements?
I'm under the impression that it's pretty regular. They're trying to get like a full eye exam done pretty regularly so that they can monitor change over time, because that's really the key here, to halt progression if possible.
Is there some information that's been gathered about some of the possible pathophysiology of some of these conditions?
That's the big question. So having worked on it myself, I kind of came up with some of my own hypotheses. But some of the main ones that are in place right now is that microgravity environments cause cephalid fluid shifts. So just the fact that we're not oriented vertically as we are on Earth up in space, that's causing cerebral venous congestion and issues with overfilling and distension is the current thought. So that's causing increased intracranial pressure. And that imbalance between ICP and IOP changes is causing a translaminar pressure gradient that's causing structural damage. Another hypothesis they're looking at is just individual anatomical genetic factors, and that's something else that can be studied more in pre- and post-flight conditions. The exact mechanism they're looking at is a folate-dependent one-carbon metabolism. And then just venous congestion, how retinal axons are being affected by fluid shifts.
That's really fascinating. So I guess that ties back to what you mentioned earlier about optic disc edema. Now we can kind of see a potential link.
Exactly.
And regarding the damage to the axons, plus you had also mentioned IOP measurements, is there any link to glaucoma or reduced perfusion in the eye that can potentially be an additional risk factor to conditions like glaucoma?
You know, that's such a great question. I don't know. I haven't seen any research that's directly tying in like glaucoma to nerve damage changes with spaceflight. I think one of the reasons is, one, a small sample size, and two, just not enough time having passed. This whole phenomenon started gaining traction and getting noticed not recently, but not enough time ago that we would be able to chart changes. quite yet, but I think that's such a great research topic to explore.
Yeah, and also, like you had mentioned, you know, some of the challenges with sample size, it didn't seem that having equipment up there is as much of a challenge as I would have expected. I know that it's really expensive to ship things to space. I think one example I'd heard was that it costs about $10,000 to ship a can of soda to space.
That's crazy. Wow.
Yeah, so I was actually surprised that they had that many pieces of equipment at their disposal up there, considering the expense of it. But considering what you'd mentioned about how severe some of these visual changes are, I can see why they made it a priority.
So you mentioned your own interest in space exploration. What are your thoughts on where we're headed in the next 30 to 50 years?
So I honestly think this is one of the most exciting topics in technology and science right now, especially because there are huge breakthroughs in space travel. So one of the big things that you may have heard of is Elon Musk's company, SpaceX, and how they're pioneering reusable space rockets. So that's been one of the big barriers in space, kind of going back to what we were talking about, how much it costs to send a can of soda in space. Well, that $10,000 price tag comes from the fact that until very recently, we would build the rocket for $60 to $100 million. We would launch it, and then the rocket would fall in the ocean, and then you'd spend another $60 to $100 million to launch another payload. So that's been, you know, a huge barrier to entry. That's why space has kind of been relegated to an area for governments, essentially, because that's been kind of the only institution that can afford to do research in space. On the commercial side, it's been a lot of satellite companies who, you know, launch multi-billion dollar satellites, and, you know, it's a small market. And as far as the range of things that they're interested in, they're only interested in things that have a large return on investment, because they do have such a large expenditure to get things into space. Elon Musk's goal has been to essentially transition rockets to a use case similar to how we use airliners today. So if we thought about booking a ticket on an airplane, if that airplane landed and had to be destroyed, you know, our ticket would be much more expensive. With SpaceX actually pioneering rockets to actually go into space and return and be actually refurbished and reusable, that can actually cause a huge shift in the whole industry. So just to give you an example, the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket costs $54 million. The rocket uses about $200,000 worth of fuel, which is about 0.4% of the total cost of the whole launch. So it's estimated that the cost of launching a certain mass into space can be reduced by a factor of up to 100. So a 100-fold decrease in any field is bound to spur innovation. And so that's one of the exciting things that I've been following and learning about. And I think it's going to cause some really interesting things to come up in the near future.
Yeah, I think one of NASA's goals is to put an astronaut on an asteroid by 2025. And, you know, there's the 2030 Mars goal. So it's going to be really exciting to see how that plays out in the very near future.
Absolutely. And I also think that it will be really interesting to see the interplay between the private sector and then also the different governments out there. So, for example, SpaceX and NASA recently collaborated on using the Falcon 9 rocket and also a new space capsule that SpaceX and also Boeing developed, each developed their own. And those are actually going to be the new way to transport astronauts to the space station. Before, NASA actually had to pay the Russian Space Agency to use their Soyuz launch vehicle to send all American astronauts to the space station. But now we actually have two American companies that are going to be offering transport back and forth.
Yeah, and I'm really excited that space travel is coming back into play. I think the upcoming trip to Mars is going to be absolutely amazing. You know, we've all been thinking about that forever. So it's a really exciting time.
Absolutely. And that really gets me thinking about what are some of the risks now that are associated with actually human beings traveling beyond low Earth orbit. I mean, we know that with the microgravity environment at the space station, we've already seen some vision changes. If we're talking about going to Mars, that's a trip that takes several months each way. So it's not like sending a rover. We're talking about human beings being in zero gravity, not microgravity, for that long. And even if they do land on Mars, that's a different gravitational environment there as well. So has there been anything that you had heard about of things that are being developed to maybe address some of those concerns?
It's always, you know, the ongoing, very intensive training regimens that our astronauts do go through. I think at this point, they're engaged in the resistive exercise, the nutritional changes, so like the high sodium intakes and getting used to the prepackaged foods and things like that. really, it goes back to the problem that we're facing. Long duration space flight is considered greater than 30 days, and they are having crew members do complete long duration space flights on the ISS in order to start practicing for the change of surface on Mars. And it just comes back to, you know, more clinical research and keeping up to date with things.
You know, one thing I'm curious about as well is, in addition to the structural changes that we've kind of touched on a little bit, is there any research being done in the direction of functional vision changes, for example, relating to oculomotor ability, accommodation ability, and being able to orient yourself in a visual sense in a microgravity environment?
That's such a great question. To the best of my knowledge, no, I don't think so. Only for the reason that the current belief is that these changes are retinal in nature for the most part, retinal and optic disc oriented. So I'm not sure that the oculomotor changes and accommodative changes have been looked at. But that's certainly a very interesting point, because we are seeing hyperopic shifts and we are definitely seeing intermittent blurry vision. And that could really be something that is playing a role in why we're having blurry vision.
Yeah, it just seems to me that a lot of our oculomotor and accommodative function is related to our perception of the space around us. And if we're in a situation where up is down and down is up, how is our visual system coping with using our eyes to actually discern information from the environment around us? That plus, you know, it seems that there are some changes to actual muscle tone and our ability to actually use our bodies in a coordinated fashion, because, you know, I do hear about when astronauts come back home that they have to almost learn to walk again, so to speak, and really learn kind of to orient themselves in space again, because they don't have that coordination or the need to have that type of coordination in space.
You absolutely raise a great point, because muscle tone is impacted. I'm going to definitely keep my ear to the ground and see if there's anything being done about that.
Maybe you can help us learn a little bit more about who is involved as far as the different professions out there. I know you had mentioned there are optometrists on the NASA team. Can you tell us about how many and who else might be involved in some of the research?
I know for sure there's a couple, the ones that I met. So Dr. Tyson Brunsetter and Dr. Robert Gibson are both very involved in the research side of things, and they've published quite a lot. There are many PhDs and MDs and medical doctors involved on the team as well. There are physiologists. You know, it's really a very mixed team, because the nature of this problem is such that it's not very clean cut. It's not just optometry. It's not just clinical. It's not just research based. It requires a lot of different minds coming together.
So Nitya, what does the future hold for you in this field? Do you have anything that you're currently working on or that you're interested in working on in the near future?
Yeah, so I'm currently working on publishing a paper with the data we found. You know, after attending ARVO and talking with people there, I have some new research directions and just some more things that I want to look at. So I'm still in the process of expanding my research project and working on getting that published. Just out of interest, keeping up with the new clinical research that's going on and sharing that and talking about it wherever I can, just because I really do think that optometry is going to have such a special role in this exciting field. And I think we're going to have the opportunity to carve out our own role in this. So I definitely want to stay involved in this as much as I can.
I couldn't agree with you more. And it's really refreshing to see someone who is so passionate about the topic and someone who not only is interested in working on it themselves, but really wants to make the effort to keep their colleagues informed and encourage them to get involved if they have an interest in that. So definitely thank you for that. I was wondering if you had any tips on kind of how to stay up to date with some of the things that are going to be developing in the field over the next few years.
The biggest tip I would have is attend national meetings, because there are talks that are given on this topic. AOA had a talk about it in 2016. I know Dr. Brunsetter presented at Academy a couple years ago as well. ARVO always has research that's being presented on the topic. It's not a huge enough field where it's just going to be easily accessible, but I think if you have the interest, it's definitely worth seeking out, because there is a place for optometry here. And even in just the new kinds of ideas that we talked about, optometry has a lot to offer in terms of building the design for any kind of new clinical research that's targeted at understanding changes in vision. So definitely just keeping up with things as much as possible in national meetings and journal articles.
That's a great point. And I personally foresee that there is an opportunity for more of these positions and opportunities to work in the field coming up now, considering that there are more private sector companies involved in space travel, and that it's not only going to be astronauts who are working for the major space agencies, but now there's also going to be employees of companies who are going to be actually in space. And so, you know, it may not be as many as the average patients that we see, but I think that the number of people who are exposed to that environment is definitely going to increase, and the demand for research and also for actual clinical care for people who are in space is definitely going to expand. So it's looking like it's going to trend in the upward direction. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
And for anyone who is interested in either reaching out to you for more information or just staying up to date with some of the things that you're going to be up to in the near future, is there a good way for them to get in touch with you or follow you on social media?
Yeah. So my first name is NITYA, last name MURTHY. I'm on social media. My Instagram handle is NITYASEES, so Nithya Sees. I'm on Twitter, just my first and last name together. I do tend to share optometry and vision related articles and things like that fairly often. And I'd love to chat if there's any optometry students who are interested in getting involved, or if there's just anybody who wants to, you know, work on this, I'd be happy to talk with anyone.
It's definitely one of the most fascinating topics really in eye care, and definitely very grateful to have you along with us to help shed a light on it. And we'll definitely be staying in touch with you, and definitely look forward to having you back for an update soon.
Thanks so much for having me. Good talking with you, Fayez.
Likewise, Nithya. Thank you. That's a wrap for this episode, but it's only the beginning of the conversation. Please share your thoughts with us in the comment section on odsonfacebook.com, as well as in the ODs on Facebook group. If you have questions for our guests that you feel the whole community would benefit from learning the answers to, then please share those in the comments as well. Our guests will be jumping in the comments to continue the discussion with the community. And if you enjoyed the podcast, make sure you subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher by searching for ODs on Facebook podcast. Thanks, everyone, and we'll catch you on the next episode.